This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at hollywoodblends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is an original member of one of the most phenomenally popular and beloved music groups of all time, the Village People, who brought us many unforgettable hits we just couldn't stop singing and dancing to, including YMCA, San Francisco, In the Navy, Macho Man, Go West, Everybody is a Star in Hollywood, I Am What I Am, and many more. They had some of the biggest hits of the 70s, and of course, the Village People starred in the classic 1980 movie, Can't Stop the Music. Our guest was dressed as an Indigenous American, along with his bandmates, Alex Briley, the military man, David Hodo, the construction worker, Randy Jones, the cowboy, Glenn Hughes, the leather man, and lead singer, Victor Willis, who was sometimes a cop and sometimes a naval officer. The Village People had enormous success with 25 gold and platinum records, an American Music Award, two Billboard Music Awards, a George M. Cohan Entertainer of the Year Award, and a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And in 2020, the American Library of Congress inducted the song YMCA into the National Recording Registry, which preserves audio recordings considered to be culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. In addition to his work with the Village People, our guest has had a great solo music career, recording singles, including Trail of Tears, We're Still Here, Red Hawk Woman, Going Back to My Roots, Dance Again, and now his brand new single, That's What You Are. Here it is. Listen to this. This single, which was released on June 21st, is now available on every major music streaming platform. Our guest has won 5 Native American Music Awards, and in 2008, he was inducted into the Native American Music Hall of Fame. I am delighted to welcome Felipe Rose to our show. Felipe, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Harvey. Harry, hello, everyone. That was a lot to listen to.
Well, you've done a lot in your life. Is it true that you were the very first member of the group recruited by the French composer and producer Jacques Morali?
You know, the story varies on depending on who's telling the story. I know, and pretty much most of our gay brothers that went to all the clubs in New York, the Anvil, 12 West, Flamingo, and all that, they know the truth. They know that Jacques recruited me when he saw me. And he was already working on the album with Victor Willis as a studio singer. And when he approached me, he heard the sound of the sleigh bells. Well, there were about 5.5 pounds of sleigh bells on each ankle. So you could hear me before you could see me. And then, of course, I was like an apparition. And that's when he got the idea, I would love for you to be on this album, on this new recording project with the sound of your bells. And I thought, okay, this is pretty cute. Why not? You know, nice payday out of the Anvil and whatever. But then when I got there, I showed up in all my native gear, my long hair all braided in the back. And I did they laid pillows down on the floor inside the studio with microphones down. So I walked into like a center of microphones around me, and basically on these pillows so that you wouldn't hear the stomping on the floor, they wanted the sound. So the pillows created that cushion, and therefore I recorded. And then about 2-3 weeks later, he comes back. Oh my God, my darling, Cherie, darling, we're going to delay. We're going to do something much bigger. We want to do a group around you. So essentially, he recruited me. I was already a New York fixture. Like today, we have the Joey Arias of New York and the Tim Mosses. And, you know, I can go on the Edwin Vasquez, all the all the people that are in the clubs in New York at Joe's Pub and what have you. So that's what I was doing back then. And actually, someone just sent me a cover of Michael's Thing, 1976. It was a bar rag, right? It was a New York nightlife magazine, right? If you wanted to figure out who was playing what, who was doing what. And so essentially, as Victor tells the story that he was first because he was recruited as a studio singer, but he had no intention of being a front lead singer until Phil Hurt, that was one of the songwriters, said, "No, I'm not going to be a lead singer to sing leads for this group. Why don't you get Victor?" And he tapped Victor, and Victor said, "Yes."
Now, you wore a Native American costume in The Village People. Tell me about your indigenous heritage.
But my dad, my mother, it's really crazy the way she told me the story. But it basically, she was going to an audition to New York to a audition at the Copacabana. And so she was already in New York City living, where she left Puerto Rico when she was 7 years old. She traveled by ship. And he was relocated in the early 1950s by the job relocation program, and basically on several reservations. So he was relocated by trade. And he ended up in New York as a welder, putting up buildings and bridges. And as she said, it was that one fateful afternoon that she had to cross out into the street because they didn't have scaffolding back in those days. You know, when they were putting up a building, they had a plywood fence, and you had to walk out on the street, you know, because of the cranes and all that. And she said he was coming down from the sky on a girder, steel girder. And of course, I asked her, who are you talking about? She said, "Your father. Now get outside and play." And then years later, because they separated when I was very young, then when the internet came in the 1995 is when we found each other. He went searching for me, I was searching for him, and we found each other. So I didn't grow up in on a reservation. I grew up, as many other natives tell me, they used to tell me back in those days, "You're a closet Indian. You're a closet native because you don't live on you don't live our tribal ways. You don't live on a reservation. You're from the big city." So knowing that, I grew up with that, and still that, okay, I need to know and learn more. And so the rest is, of course, as we say, it's history.
What tribe was your father part of?
He was a mixture, like my mother was Puerto Rican and Italian. He was a mixture of Lakota, Sioux, and Apache.
Now, in the late 70s, The Village People became a worldwide sensation, and you appeared on a whole slew of TV shows. You were even on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. How did you handle that sudden fame?
Well, it was difficult, to say the least, because of course, only finding out recently when I started like getting into my stories and my memories, jogging my memory about, you know, where was I when I met Jacques Morali? I didn't realize, not up until recently, because I've been working on a book, that I was homeless when I met him. I had a job. I had the anvil. I had the ballet company. I was making some money. I had one key. I was renting, I don't know, space on a couch or in a room with another performer. So I didn't really have a home. And that's quite fascinating that he, you know, tapped me during that time when he saw me all over New York, and especially in the clubs, dressed in my gear. It was difficult because, A, there was no one else around like that, dressing that way, tapping into their ethnic indigenous heritage like I was. Also, it was strange because the turn and the switch of temperature, at first the elation of the group, "Oh, we have a gay group, a representation, we feel like you're one of us." And then when with the popularity gained traction on television all over the world, then the very same people that were proud of that were saying, "You sold us out. You went on TV and you're promoting our gay lifestyle to the masses." Well, we have no control of that because I always get out of the argument or disagreement. It's called show business. I'm not here to promote myself personally or sexually. At the time, it was not cool to do that, even on TV. Like today, it's great. I still get a rush when I hear of other our LGBTQ family celebrities or whatever, and they're talking about their project, and they say, "My husband this," and my, and to hear it, it's still to me, it's joyous to see how far we've come.
But how does it feel, Felipe, to be part of a group that was seen as the ambassador for the gay community? That's what you were.
Well, it was at the time. I mean, it was quite an honor, and it was a really beautiful thing. And I had many people, a lot of men that I came across in concerts and clubs that would say to me, "You know, I'm gay because of you." And I would look at them and I would say, "No, you're gay because you wanted to come out of the closet. It had nothing to do with me." But the point is, that being said, it was, you know, I happened to be at the right place at the right time. So did the group. When we speak of where we were, the time capsule during that time, and polarized as we were in the country, we were under a Republican presidency, Reagan, you know, and at the time when the group first came out, you know, that wasn't something that you just could like say on television, "I'm gay and I have a husband." Oh, you could never, you know, even on the Merv Griffin show. And, you know, the thing with me, honestly, as a disciplined artist, because when you trained early in life, especially as a young man, and you take dance classes and ballet classes and all of that discipline that goes into that, you walk away with that. That nurtured in your system. So I was able to, you know, professionally speaking, show up for the job. But when it came to talking about myself in that capacity, it was just like, no, I just never crossed that line. Today I would. You know, but I lend myself politically as an activist, because when the first album came out in 1977, whatever, it was like against the backdrop of the Anita Bryant movement. So here I am celebrating and marching in the, what was it, Christopher Street Liberation Parade, which is the Pride Parade today. And then there's a, and that has evolved. That march, that parade as we know it today, was never like that. You know, it had its grassroots, you know this. And so the interesting thing was, here I stepped out to celebrate myself with the new album dropping. And all of that political craziness against our community. And then I became an instant, I was celebrating myself as a recording artist, a celebrity, right? And then I immediately became an activist, all in the same, in the same day.
Did you feel like a sex symbol? Because that's how we young gay guys, that's how we saw you. We thought you were all really sexy.
You know, I knew I was a sex symbol because I was wearing nothing. I was wearing a breech cloth, and mind you, then once I left the clubs and I had to step out in public and on stage, I had to wear a little G-string, jock strap G-string, you know.
Believe me, we all noticed.
And so I never even, you know, I knew I was sexy. I knew I was like, but I didn't carry that too hard a word on my as a sleeve on my sleeve. You know, look at that guy. Yeah, he's sexy. Yep, I know it because I'm dressed this way. But the group itself, it was fascinating to see how high they rose as far as everyone's favorite in the group. Everyone around the world had a favorite. And that was the beauty about the group. We weren't just five backup singers. In fact, they called us, I forget what trade magazine called the Village People as the five front ground singers because of the characters and personalities We injected our personality. Well, mine was already developed and established, but each of the guys injected their personality of who they were according to the cowboy type, the construction. David was far from a construction worker. Like when they told him he was going to be a construction worker, and he was only waiting to see if he could get unemployment a couple of more weeks and went on an audition. And of course, he found out that he was going to be the construction worker for the village people while he was wearing his pink Lacoste shirt. They handed him a helmet and a belt. That's all he got. Whereas me, I mean, I didn't really need anything at the beginning because I walked in all in tribal gear. But that as the years, moved on and one album released after another, my stage gear became more elaborate. To the point that to the tune that the construction that the biker Glenn always had a problem. Why are we spending so much money on this headdress? And then this, we don't get to spend that much money. And it's interesting that a manager put it very mildly, he said, and professionally, this headdress costs as much as this pen for your company. That headdress brings money. And this pen writes the checks that you pay out. So they all go together. And it was interesting to see it like that. The breakdown of the characters, how much that we could spend on each of them. But of course, with me, my no bar, bars hold, I have an extensive collection of turquoise jewelry.
But you were the only member of the group that didn't just represent being gay. You were representing an entire race, a culture.
At the time, I didn't really know the impact until other elders and other community, Native community leaders started reaching out to me through Casablanca Records and the office in New York. And so instead of, getting wild up about it or puffing up and catching an attitude about it, I would reach out again. And say, well, what is it that you want me to do? Is there anything I'm doing wrong in misrepresenting? And they're all, no, you're not misrepresenting. But if you're not, then we really want you to stop dressing that way. I said, well, then I explained it. And then, so show me how. So it was interesting that I flew around the country meeting other elders from the St. Carlos Apache tribe, other reservations, going and speaking to other Native students. So then I sort of stepped into a new following, a new reintroduction of what was missing in New York, which I don't see Native people. But when I travel around the country, like when I moved to Richmond, Virginia, they were there. I could see them, I could find them. I knew exactly where Natives were living. In fact, Richmond, Virginia had when I was living there, eight unfederated tribes, which was the Red Hawk Woman album. That's what it was about. And that won a Native American Music Award. So as I was approached by various organizations, Unity Program, United National Indian Tribal Youth Council, and things like that, I would then say, well, then I need to know more. Please show me. And then in doing so, what's the best way to give back? You set up small scholarships. So then I started working in New York with the American Indian College Fund and even had the group do two free concerts. They were like, why should we give a free concert? I said, well, I think it's time we get a lot from our fans all over the world. I think once a year we should pick a benefit and throw a free concert. And they looked at me bewildered, because a lot of times people fall into this magnetic and this amazing career, and it's all about money and it's all about getting, gimme, gimme, gimme. But then when you realize, okay, I'm getting, but now what do I do to sustain and put myself back out there to say thank you? You give back. So we started doing concerts. We would pick like two or three concerts a year to give back. And so that was nice.
I'm so glad you mentioned that because in the late 90s, you appeared in Toronto at an AIDS benefit and you allowed your fans to come on the stage and dance with you. And I was one of those fans. And I could tell you,
Are you serious?
I
No,
so
seriously.
love it was a benefit for MAC.
How old were you?
I must have been
Yeah, 20s, thirties,
early
20s.
40s maybe,
Oh,
and
okay.
you
I
guys were
remember that.
the big act for the Fashion Cares, it was called, and
Fashion care.
MAC Cosmetics sponsored it. But you allowed us to come up and dance with you, and I was about 5 inches from you, and it was a dream come true. And I can't believe now I get to interview you. It's like it's so surreal to me.
You know what's funny is that that I've known you even from then. I've known your name around from other people that we know, like Tony Orlando, who's a dear friend. He's like a brother. Wendy Stewart. Like I know. A matter of fact, when I finally friended you on social media, like I think it was on Facebook, and you jumped to the window, there you were with all these other people that you know that I know, and the world is very tiny. It's really small.
Well, it's really small, and I'm glad I get a way to tell you publicly
Thank
that
you.
I had a very hard time with my family when I came out in the late 70s. I was in law school trying to get through, even though I'd been kicked out, and your music was incredibly inspiring to me. You guys brought so much joy. Now, of course, I have to ask you about the movie Can't Stop the Music. What was it like working with Bruce Jenner, who is now Caitlyn Jenner?
Oh, man. He wasn't nice then, and she was not nice now. That's all I don't know what to say about that. He just wasn't a very nice person, wasn't warming, including us in things. And even if we joined in like a basketball during off time to play around and shoot hoops in the movie lot or whatever, because he wanted that. He needed a basketball, or whatever, and he needed a bike so he could go riding up Malibu or whatever. And even playing with him, he would cheat. He's a cheater. So I was like, oh my God, this guy is not nice at all. But listen, again, it was the same thing that happened with the group. Strangers were thrown together to work together. It was the same thing with the movie. We were thrown together, and that movie was a mess, a hot mess. Because, first of all, you had Alan Carr after Jacques Marali. The ex-producer, the French producer that recruited me and Victor, the three of us are the Trinity that put the whole thing together, the concept-wise. I thought that there would never be a really more flamboyant queen or gay man than Jacques Marali, and in comes Alan Carr. I was like, what the? Help me, someone help me. What is going on? And they didn't like each other. So imagine trying to do a movie with that. With that in that environment where everyone is either paranoid or doesn't like each other, like Valerie and Bruce hated each other. They hated Nancy Walker. It was a mess. And then the movie had like six titles. Disco Land, where the music never ends. It just went on and on. By the time we got the movie script during the 1979 World Tour, US Tour. By the time we got to New York and Madison Square Garden, they decided to make a big deal of it and bring in all the stars for the film that would start filming in September. So it was Alan Carr on the stage, and we got the script. And I can remember the dressing rooms in these arenas, they're not small, like my office. You could be sitting like 40 feet away, 60 or 200 feet away, maybe more. And this script comes flying. He comes flying past me and hits the wall. David Hodo, he looked at the script, looked at the first 10 pages. He said, "This piece," and he threw it at him. "This sucks." And we're like, "Oh my God." Yep, we were stuck with it. We were being managed. We did this movie that we really didn't. You didn't need all those people. You really didn't need Valerie Prime. What's her name? Bruce Jenner, Tammy Grimes, Marilyn Sokol. You didn't need Altavis Davis. You didn't really need all those people, but they thought that the group probably can't act. And therefore, the movie that was really us and the ad libs and things that we did, along the way ended up on the cutting room floor. That was the movie right there, But listen, what are you going to do when there's 19 world premieres and you're stuck knowing that? right out of the box, it got slammed by the critics. Awful movie, it's the worst. Also, we were hit by other various situations happening culturally. And also what was going on, the death of disco coincided with the release of the movie and the double-sided album Live in Sleazy, plus a soundtrack. So while the changing of disco and the radio turning disco off, we were then had to figure out how do we survive this? How do we save these albums in the US or throw them in the garbage? Thank God we had the rest of the world. And then the next phase that came in, to no fault of our own, and it was disastrous and it's horrific and still horrific to know that during the AIDS crisis, how many people I know that are gone, you know, and how brave, how many of them were brave to just survive and live through the danger and knowing that in their capacity, their mental capacity, that there was no way out. They're going to die. Some of them were homeless. Some of them, like yourself and myself, tossed out of our homes. We find our way home. We find our tribe. So it was really heart, you know, it was sad. It was a sad time. And yet the group continued to stay together, working in other parts of the world. But every time we kept coming home, it was just the AIDS crisis just was really awful. And then, of course, you could see village people together in an airport. We weren't dressy kind of guys. It's a denim and jeans kind of group. I mean, think about it. Not dressed like you. Like, I dress like that when I'm out. I like putting on a nice shirt, nice jacket. Back then, occasionally I would get dressed. But then there were times when we would be boarding, we would board flights. And people, of course, would look at us and they would recognize us, and they didn't want village people sitting next to them because of AIDS. You know, in fact, there were people that would say, "Oh no, I can't. You're with the village people." No, you, and they would, "Can you change my seat?" Like they would literally leave. Yeah. So we went through that. You know, what was it? Guilt by association. It's the lifestyle we were promoting. How do you get out of that? You just keep pushing along. And then we would return, and that's when we started doing going to I got involved with ACT UP, the candlelight vigils, visiting other friends of friends at hospital in St. Vincent, taking teddy bears with ruby rims, and also many, many memorials. So at that time, in my mid-20s, here I am going attending funerals or memorials that I was not even prepared to be doing till now, later in life.
It was a very, very hard time, and your music was one of the few times that we could really celebrate some joy. Now, you mentioned the changes that you went through. When I look at the history of the Village People over the years, there were a lot of members of the group who came and left, but you stayed until 2017. Were you happy in the group for most of that time?
I wasn't happy at the time, most of the time. I realized that I stayed in the group well, way too long beyond the time allotted when, you know, one should strike out and go solo. And because it was my first family, I didn't have a family. I was homeless. And then suddenly I had a family. I had brothers that became a part of my life. I didn't want to let go of that. So I used the same old playbook that Jacques Morali used, replacing other guys by type. And so then I just took over with when Victor left, then Ray Simpson came in. And then we did break up right in late 84, 85, and that was it. I thought I would never go back again. And then in, of course, 87, I got a call from Randy Jones and said, "Oh, you know, we're all in Musical Theater Works in New York City, and we're all in a meeting here, and we want to know, would you come back with us if we get together?" I said, "No, I don't know that I want to do that again. And if we did, we would have to do it for ourselves. We'd have to be the bosses." Because the one sad thing about The one thing that the producers did was they oversaturated the group. We were on every television show. It was like up to here. You couldn't turn the TV off or on without seeing the group. And so that was overkill. But then, of course, I continued replacing because I knew that, okay, this is how many years now I'm well, now going into my 30s. Now it's about money. It's about working to sock money away for retirement because I knew where I would be today. I fast forward thinking, said, no, pay yourself first. So I toured the world. I love touring the world, the cachet of being on a plane, being in really top-notch concerts, Australia 39 times in my life. But that the main thing in the focal point was after you hit a certain age, I said, let me just stay with this train as long as it can go to keep putting money into my retirement, which was great.
So, what would you say was your happiest period as a member of the group?
I would say when I would walk away from work and then come home and get together with family and friends and work on my music. Now, when I'm in the studio and when I'm collaborating, I'm the happiest.
When you look at the people that you worked with in the group over the years, was there a particular makeup of the group that you found the best, that you liked the most? Like you mentioned David Hodo, you mentioned Randy Jones.
I mean, we were still friends. We weren't close friends. Like when we would land and we would arrive home, everybody would just go their separate ways. And I mean, I know I tried a couple of times to get tickets for some big Broadway show and also for the Grammys. Let's get tickets and let's just show up. You know, let the car pull up, red carpet, going to the Grammys at Radio City. And they were like, no, we don't want to do it. And that was kind of a blow to me because every attempt that I wanted us to be seen together out in public, you know, imagine just stepping on a red, going to attend and then the group appears. You know, it's not like we can't have cause and effect in any room, place, wherever we walk together because we definitely had a brand, a look, you know? And so when I started realizing that that's all it was, that there was nothing more other than, there was nothing better for them than to just hit the road and make money and then go home. So that outside of that, I realized that there was never going to be anything more than that. So, yeah, those were the disappointing times. But then, you know, you have to do with you have to work with what you've got.
Felipe, you and I are friends. We've talked on the phone several times. I consider you a friend, and I can say this that I know you've had a lot of stress over the years with lawsuits over the use of the name, the Village People. How did those lawsuits affect you? Are you willing to talk about that?
Well, the lawsuit basically, you know, it's interesting because when the litigation and the lawsuit ended in 2020, there was really no more time to think about it other than go right into PTSD with the shutdown, the lockdown. So I was able to assess all of that, figure out where I am in my life, and then, okay, now how do we get out of this hole? How do we climb out of this? And it was interesting. I didn't like being locked in my house with my pets, but I also enjoyed it because I found out a little bit more about myself and then started really tapping into, okay, that happened, but because you can't control anything that you say and do, or you have no control over what people say and do. So that was okay. It happened. Time to get up. Time to move on. And
But
so then
where
I.
are you able to explain to the viewers who are not familiar, why were you being sued for $1.5 million?
Well, the thing is that the ex-producers, they had a fight, a legal fight with the ex-lead singer, Victor Willis, for his music, for his publishing, and all of that. And that rolled over on us because we were using the name all the time. And so therefore, when they lost the trial, they decided, let's just give him the trademark name. He gets his publishing and his percentage and his all that. And now we want to be done with it. let's just give him the name of the trademark. Of course, I had to raise my hand and say, I've got the trademark. And so they sued, then they sued. So we got sued twice. And that basically, it was all about the rights of the name, who owned it, and the music. And so, being that the ex-producers were caught stealing money and royalties, which, all of that got was eventually fixed, rectified. Well, we did find it was established and proved in the trial that the ex-producer, who's dead now, Henri Bellolo, had his hands in the music, the casino machines, the commercial music. So if, listen, I have no animosity towards Victor at all. He and I never had a fight. He had every right to go after his what belonged to him. Because if he wrote those songs, he should own his percentage. Why should these producers make all the money, live in lavish mansions and villas, and yet here we are, just like, okay, we have nice homes, we have nice money in the bank, but it's not the villas that we have and the ship, the yachts. You know what I mean? Where's that? We don't have that. And so when they got caught, they decided it would be better to throw the towel in, give him the name. And then once he had the name, I was trying to get it all to work together, keep the two lead singers, train Victor, get him in fighting shape, because he was like a boxer. When we hit the road, that vocal of his, he was like the disco Teddy Pendergrass. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Oh,
His
his voice
voice
was
was, his body
perfect.
was, he was just like a boxer. I was hoping to see if we could get him in boxing, in form, to be back again and get on the road. Because when we were on the road for the 38 years that we had the trademark name, and with Ray Simpson and the others, we were like a machine. In fact, you saw us live. We were like a machine, well-oiled, well-choreographed. The harmonies in perfect pitch for four, three-part, four, five-part harmonies. Everything had to be. And so I was hoping that, we can train, keep one in training, fighting, shaping, shape, form, keep the other lead singer, swap them out. And I was hoping that then one steps in and the other one can sit down. That didn't work out. So there we were. It ended. And now there's a whole new Village People.
Are you part of the whole new Village People?
Oh, I never want to do that again. And I have very strong advice for everyone out there that sings, wants to be in a band, wants to be in a girl group. Don't do it. Don't. It's not worth it. I mean, if you're gonna be in a group, a singing group, if it's gonna be like the Supremes, as you're gonna get a mile mileage out of it. And I think that the case in point, who's done it very well, was Destiny's Child. They did it nicely, and Beyoncé left on good terms and went solo. Their breakup was sort of like see you later, because they're gonna get back together again, without no doubt. Let this cowboy phase be over. And so there was a way to step in and step out of it. And yeah, I would never recommend being in a boy band or a group ever, ever. Not good.
But you don't regret it, do you?
I don't regret it. I just wish that I had more sense to have been able to be more in control of what I wanted instead of what everyone else wanted. I'm that guy that wants to keep everybody kumbaya, Felipe. Can we all get together? Let's all get in a circle.
Well, I think everyone thought that you got very rich from the group, and that's just not true. You did not.
I money invested. I do very well. I live very well. Rich in the sense of the millions. I mean, it depends. Of course, you're rich when you look at your tax returns, you see how much money you paid out, 33.5%, and you start doing the math, and you start figuring out, okay, I bought my mother a house, I bought myself a house, I had a condo, I left four cars. The reason why I got all the cars, got rid of them, was my dad, my late dad said to me, son, why do you have four cars? And I said, well, I like the different cars, and I like to drive one different car every other day. He says, but your butt can only ride one at a time. Like, he said, isn't that expensive? And I said, oh, you know what? And then you start pulling back, you know? And that was what happened in 2020, that I went on a disco cruise as solo while the litigation was coming to an end. And I found a tap back into that disco crowd. And I was there by myself, and people were emotional. Oh my God, thank you so much. And I thought, okay, you know what? This was a good run. I can do this by myself. And next thing you know, I come back from Florida 2020, and that ended in January, and 2020, March 13th, closed, lockdown. So I started again putting my show together, writing about, going through my memoir notes, notebooks, and things, and thinking, man, I think maybe I should work on a book. So out of the pandemic, a lot of good came out of it.
I'm very happy to hear that. Before we start talking about your solo career, as you know, a few months ago we had Mark Saltarelli on the show talking about his documentary film Studio One Forever. Can you share any memories of being at Studio One in West Hollywood?
Studio One Forever. The movie as well, beautiful documentary. And I'm so happy that he actually, with Bruce Valanche and the other guys, Michael Koth and all of them, what was it, five guys that decided to reminisce about Studio One because it was going to be torn down. And Studio One ran for 19 years, and it was that's where Studio 54. They went out, Schrager and Lubell with friends went out, let's see what the Studio One is all about. And what they found out was that the back lot, which was when you left the big club of like maybe 800, 900 men dancing without shirts on, and you go down the long hallway, then you'd see the bathrooms, and you would continue down the long hallway into the next building. That was the back lot, and that's where you had all the Hollywood stars. Bette Midler, Julie Budd, you had, oh my God,
Liza.
Liza was there, Charlotte Crossley from the Harlettes. I mean, the entertainers in Hollywood, in LA, they would be there at night on the weekends. So Rubel heard that and they said, well, let's see if we can have the same thing but integrated. And so they went back home and they found that theater, which I think they had on 54th Street. So they called it Studio 54 instead of Studio One because it was on 54th Street. And it only lasted 3 years. Isn't that something? So Studio One, the trajectory that and how we are tied together, the group and the music, we're tied together with it, is because on the first album in the San Francisco Hollywood, San Francisco, You Got Me Hollywood, in the breakdown, we yell out, Studio One, and that's where the breakdown happens. Lights, camera, action. And then 3.5 years later, we're back at Studio One in the parking lot of the back lot with mobile homes. They were all our trailers for the film. We were there a week and a half. And so that was like a city back there with all the dancers and all the stars in the film. And we played there at Studio One. We filmed literally for a week. And that scene on the bar where I'm dancing across the bar and there's electricity and all that, Alan found out that along with the dancers, Hot Gossip, and myself, he found out that we all dropped acid. Because that Friday, at the end of the week, Alan said there was an announcement that we're going to shoot on Saturday all day long. Into the night, late afternoon, do the pickup scenes. What was that scene that you had with so and so? Let's get all those scenes done. And then in the evening, they just let it go. They had all the extras, all the dancers, and so I had to dance for hours. So I just took acid with everyone else and just danced the night away while they just filmed and filmed and filmed.
Was that a regular thing for you? Because you never seemed like a druggie to me.
No, you know, the thing is that I don't have an addictive personality. So I've been around people that were doing eight balls, and not that I didn't, crack an eight ball in my life once or twice or a few times. It's that I don't have an addictive personality, so I could walk away from something and never do it again. But when I found out that the dancers, were gonna drop acid, I said, well, I want to do the same because I used to dance at the Anvil, and at the Anvil, I had to dance all night long. So with you, with the fire dancer, we would drop Mescaline or Mickey Mouse, Window Pane, and we would just trip dancing the night away. I'm not there to talk to the customers. I'm there as an apparition, a visual. That was it. And the same thing with what happened when we were filming, and it was great. We had fun. But listen, we were young, right?
Yeah, I remember those days. And now I want to ask you about your solo career, Felipe, your new single, That's What You Are. What was the inspiration for that song?
I didn't have a love song. My songwriter, Benny Harrison, he gives me this. Okay, I fell in love with the track, and it was very Latin, the kind of Latin. You could give it to Ricky Martin or Maluma, somebody else. But I said, he said, you don't have a love song, and I have this song, and I think you should re-record it because, you're a macho man. You went off to the Navy. You hang out at the YMCA. You've gone west. Well, and he threw in all the names of the songs of the group. He said, but you don't have a love song. I said, oh, that's interesting. You're right. And when you really think about it, I never really sang about love in music, the group, right? And so, I played around with the lyrics. I said, okay, this is, yeah, I like this. So I took it to my other producer. And we sat and we banged out the new track. And then when Lenny Fontana, he's a remixer, legendary from Studio 54 back in those days, second generation, the studio when it reopened. So Lenny and a few other guys, they were then the second generation of DJs. He said, let me remix this for you. Let me turn it into a house record, because it was like a Latin pop song. Let me turn it into a house record, a house song. And I said, yeah, but I'm not a house singer. He said, no, it has nothing to do with that. It's your attitude, it's your headspace, getting in that pocket of the song. And so here we have it. That's what you are.
It's a great song. Do you have any
Thank you.
plans to release an entire album?
It was a soft launch, but now it's out on the Amazon Music, iTunes. I gotta now find all the links and start throwing them up. And yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited. I mean, it would be nice to get back out there and perform again solo. I know if I was a drag queen, I'd be making a lot of money and working a lot, which I thought maybe if I went the other way and became a beautiful drag queen, maybe I would be more. No. And
No.
I've mentioned that even to my straight friends, and they look at me like, hell no, we have
No.
nothing against drag queens, but not you. I'm like,
No,
I
I'm
just
with
say.
them. I'm not you. You mentioned your live show. You did have a live show, Dare to Disco. Is there another live show coming?
I know that I'm going to be doing some isolated performances throughout the summer, and the Dare to Disco is really not finished, but basically I inject some stories of my life with the songs I sing, and I've done some great covers of the Peter Brown Dance With Me, going back to my roots. And so it's a story of like daring you to remember what I remember, but daring you to see if you can party just as hard as I can while I'm on stage and you're down there, or you're on the dance floor, or you're sitting in your chair. No, get up. So we'll see. It's right now. This is all new to me now again, because when I put out the single Dance Again in 2021. We only had one foot in the house, and we weren't really back in the clubs. So there was really nowhere to go and promote it. And so now, yeah, we'll get back. I'll get back to fine-tuning the show.
Well, that's very exciting because I think we will be looking forward to an album. We'll be looking forward to Felipe Rose on tour. Now, for a while, you had a very popular podcast called Disco Chronicles, which I really enjoyed. Why did you stop doing it?
It was too much work. You have to write a show, and then there's producing pre-production, then editing, and then reaching out to all of the other disco people that did not get back to me, because I don't know if they are familiar with the internet and know about Zoom. But there were weekends when we sat there weeks, like they never got back to us. And I'm going to just say it like this. I may be 70 years old, but I'm internet savvy, you know. And I don't know if it was whether it was intimidation or what kind of a show is it going to be. So they never, a lot, I didn't get a lot. Linda Clifford's interview was beautiful. It was great. Yeah. And then I did Carol Williams. There were a few, Lenny Fontana, Tony Orlando was on the show. So then I just moved towards, okay, well, then if we can't get the people that sang, even my friend Gloria Gaynor, like she never even sang. Her manager never even got back to me. Let's get producers. Let's get remixers. Let's talk to people that worked on covers of albums. So then it became like, where's this really going? And so we shelved it. It's sitting, it's out there, like just sitting.
Yeah, it's not worth
your
energy.
Not like your show.
Well, it takes an enormous amount of work, and you're probably one of the few people that really understands how hard this is to do. But I'm still sitting here in shock because you said you're 70 years old. Felipe, you look about 40.
Oh my God, please. Well, today I feel 40.
Now, I understand there's going to be a biopic about the Village People, or more specifically about Victor Willis. How do you feel about that?
I think it's great. I mean, I think the biopic, of course, it'll probably be his life. I'm going to be involved in it from what I'm hearing so far, because it's really going to fall during the period of the only 2.5 year period of when the group started. So you have whoever's going to portray Jacques Morali, me, and Victor. But then it's not going to be so much about the others in the group. It's going to, how did it get started? What happened to him? What happened to me? What happened to him? So who knows? That's all I know. That's for next year. It's Primary Wave and the Willis Estate. And you know, hopefully things will move along in the later in the year. And I'll know more about it. And then, of course, once things get rolling, I have to wait and let them make the announcement. I have to be on social media, say nothing. So so because of the biopic and the documentary, my new manager says, stop the book, stop the editing right now. So that when all that gets ready to go into production, get back to the editing.
And so we can expect that at
some point, will be a book.
There will be a book.
Yeah, but he wants me to drop it right before the movie opens. And I said, I really can't do that. He said, why not? You should. It's your story. That's one story, you know, and that's the thing of the beauty about the group is that when you wanted to find out, how do I get to Mount Vernon, or how do I get to Bear Mountain, or the World Trade Center, and the, you know, anywhere, you would ask the group and you get 6 ways to go. This way, no, it'd be better if you go. And we would leave the people there and go into this discussion, and they would be standing there, go, okay, never mind, thank you.
Do you think that maybe one day there will be a Broadway musical about the Village People?
Oh, there you go. I thought you were going with a reunion. Yeah, I mean, that's the reason why they're doing a movie. You can't have a Broadway musical without having a movie. You need a biopic first. You can't just throw a musical of a group like that on Broadway without all the people that go into New York from all over the Middle America and wherever, to just see a musical on the group and go, oh, well, let me go see it. There's got to be a biopic first, you know?
So I think, based on what you just said, the answer to the question, will there ever be a reunion, is no. Why not?
It was too much bad blood. The way it ended it badly. The way members ended. See, with me, you know, I am not going to, and I think that also, and thank you again for the compliment on the way I look. I think that this is a personification of what's inside of what you see, is the shine, the happiness, the let go of all of that. You have no control of all of that. If I wish and could snap my finger and wish them all back together, I would do it in a heartbeat. But let's face facts, all groups don't have happy endings. Did I like the way it ended? I didn't. Would I like to see a residency one day? Would be nice. But everyone is so different. And also physically, I don't know that it's possible.
Well, I just hope that you know that the place that you and the other group members hold in the history of pop music, in the gay community, the 70s is huge. Like, you're really beloved.
I find that every day. And I'm grateful to that every day. And I'm still meeting people every day that look at me and go, wait, yeah, I know who you are. And then they have this huge smile on their face. And they always say, thank you. So with all of that being said, like a little while ago that you said that when you that those songs, you had those songs that gave you hope. I never really looked at them that way till you just recently said that. So for that, I'm grateful that we were able to fulfill that part of what's missing in someone's life if they're either trying to transition into a lifestyle that may not be popular with your friends and your family. And like my mother, she wasn't down with that. My father didn't care. My stepfather didn't care. My dad didn't care. And also in the native tradition, we're called twin spirited, two spirited people, and two spirited people are regarded in high esteem in all tribes because they, first of all, can take care of the children, and then we gay people can take care of the elders. So that's why they're so regarded in society, in native society. And if many people don't know that, I think it's a beautiful thing to see that they're not shunned away, whereas our parents and many people I know have had that experience where they were told to leave because they weren't happy with their choice. And that's why like I did, I left Brooklyn and crossed the Brooklyn Bridge and went to New York and lived in the village and got an audition with a dance company, went to the village and started hanging out at the Ninth Circle and at Danny's and Julius's and started meeting and my tribe and making friends and you survive. You move in. You move into your new life.
I think you did more than that. I think you unwittingly became an enormous role model for two-spirited people, for gay people. You provided a certain kind of music that we've never heard before. Your shows were very visual, they were sexy, they were fun. And I'm just so glad we had you on the show because
Oh, thank
You
you. Thank
look
you.
great. You sound great. You're full of joy and optimism and happiness. There's so much more coming. I can't wait to have you back on the show when the movie comes out and when your book comes out. Please come back.
Harvey, I will certainly do that. And I don't know when I missed you in New York by a day. It
Yes.
was somewhere that you did. Oh, you were with Wendy. But Wendy and Tim, I said, oh man, if I would have gone, I would have known I would have gone all the way into New York and gone to the East Side to see you.
We will definitely get together. I
I
will
do
make.
remember you dancing on the cell, all of us. So you guys all dancing. But it was a great, that Mac party was amazing.
Yeah, and you raised a lot of money for AIDS.
We did.
I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me about the Village People, which was such an important part of our lives. Thank you for the success that you brought to our community. Thank you for the pride that you brought to the Indigenous community. I wish you the best of luck with the new single and with your career. And thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our
Thank you.
show.
I appreciate that, Harvey. And I want to thank all your listeners and not just native people, but Latinos too, because I also have to remember que mi gente, I have to always keep them the apoyo, always keep them in to remember that they're there in my life as well. But it's been an absolute honor and a privilege. It's a privilege to be in this position to be still after so many years of recording with village people to still, this many decades later, to still be loved.
You are loved and you are beloved, and I thank you again for being on our show.
Should that be the name of my book, The
Absolutely. Our guest has been the wonderful Felipe Rose, whose brand new single, That's What You Are, is now available on every major music streaming service. For more information about Felipe Rose, please go to his official website, feliperose.com. And of course, you can follow him on Facebook, X, Instagram, TikTok, and on his official YouTube channel. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my managers, Rick Marcelli and Robin Bragg Marcelli at the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XPTV One Network in the UK.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. By honoring your sacred vocation of education, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. At Grand Canyon University, our online bachelor's, master's, and doctoral education degree programs allow you to balance online coursework with observational and hands-on experience in the field. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.